good one.
Are the mics on? Yeah. Did you guys hear me say that? Excellent. So now everyone knows that I have a really great Elliot Switzer story that you guys might be able to hear if you see me at a club later. And it'll be completely off the record, and I'll try not to say it into a microphone. Hello, everyone. How's your day going? Good. My name is Tamara. I am the editor of Billboard. I'm really excited to have this motley crew of men up here on the panel with me. I just want to ask a quick question of the audience. How many developers do we have in the crowd? Fantastic. How many artists? Great. Record labels? Representing. Fantastic. Is there any group I'm missing? Shout out. People? There are people here? Bloggers? Journalists?
Ex-attorney generals.
Is Elliot Spitzer in the room? I'd just like to kick it off with having each panelist introduce themselves to the audience and give a real quick primer on what exactly you do. Will you start, Simon?
Hi, my name is Simon Wheeler. I'm the director of digital for the biggest group of labels based in London and New York. I'm also the chairman of the Association of Independent Music's New Media Committee, which is the trade association for UK indie labels. I've been working and licensing in digital music since 1997, and it's a very interesting period of time. So the ad-supported music, which we're talking about here today, is a relatively new development in the online space. And there's been a couple of announcements recently about new deals which we've done, so I'm sure they'll be dropping into the conversation as we go on. Thanks.
Steve?
I'm Steve, Steve Jang from iMeam. I do marketing, biz dev, and product management over at iMeam, and we are a social media network. We're actually, our two-year anniversary of launch is today. We launched here at South by Southwest in March of 2006. So we are growing fast. We are an online community of fans, artists, and now a lot of things happening on the filmmaker and video side as well. So we are truly an online community for media expression and discovery. We've got 25 million unique users now monthly to the site globally. And we have over 75 million widgets and apps in anywhere from MySpace to Facebook to blogs and artist sites as well.
How many people in the audience use iMeam? Pretty good. Cool. You can raise your hand too. It's okay.
Listen very carefully. One of my issues. There are many of them.
You're up.
Oh, Ted. I'm up. Hi, my name. I'm Ted Maiko, Aries. What do I do? I carry tomorrow's.
We're getting star signs later.
I carry tomorrow's bags when she goes to panels. And I also, in my spare time, I do head of digital and business development for Interscope, Geffen, and A&M Records, which is the largest music group within UMG. And before that, I was at EMI Capital. And before that, I was head of marketing and programming for Launch and Yahoo Music. And then, I don't know, there was a before that as well, but I can't remember that far back. What do we do? We do as many deals as we possibly can. We're trying to reinvent the business as we go and try and make some money in the process.
Hi, my name is Peter Rojas. I am the founder of a new site called Record Label, and that's rcrdlbl.com. Like, if you have to visit Record Label without the vowels.com, it'll get you there. It is a online, ad-supported digital label. We release completely free, completely DRM-free MP3s from a variety of artists, including ones we signed directly to the site, and ones from a network of about 15 different indie labels that also release music through us. And I think this week we will break 325 artists that we've released music from in the past 3.5 months.
Wow. Over the past couple of years, a big debate, well, there's been many big debates, but, the one thing I've heard on the label side is, how do you compete with free? How do you do that? And there's been a whole lot of different ways of trying to, whether it's subscription services or download services. So the ad-supported model is very interesting because it is free to the consumer, but the labels still get paid. So I kind of want to ask Simon and Ted first about how the ad-supported model works for your business, as opposed to some of the other sites that are out there. Simon, you can start.
Thanks. Well, like I said in my intro, it's still a very new business in this space. I mean, there are a few notable exceptions. People like Yahoo have been providing music content, mainly video content, but also audio for some time. But as far as ad-supported, as it's generally discussed, it is a very, very new business. And I think with any new business, there's a period where it's got to mature and the revenues have got to mature. So it's quite a challenging area for us to work in. There's a certain value to music rights, and when we negotiate with these new businesses, we've got a fairly clear idea what that value is. The challenge is for those businesses to be creating enough revenue to pay for the value of those rights, and that's at this stage is proving quite difficult. I think the CPMs where they are now doesn't really generate enough, you know, if we're being honest, to cover the value of the rights. So it's a very difficult space to license correctly. We've got a real responsibility to our artists to be delivering value back to them from our licensing. So while it would be very easy for us to go out there and make many, many deals, if those deals aren't actually delivering revenue back through us to the artist, then I think we'll be failing that responsibility. So we're trying to license as many people as possible, but do it in a responsible way.
How do you figure out what the value is? I mean, it's an I mean, because it's, I understand what you're saying, and you don't have to answer that. I'm just curious if you're looking at what is the value and what value do you have to deliver back both to your company and to the artists?
Well, I mean, we're dealing with some fairly simple sets of rights, I think, really. And when we're dealing with either streaming, and that streaming can be non-interactive, semi-interactive, or fully on demand, or we're dealing with downloads, or we're dealing with video streaming, and all these things exist in other businesses.
So pennies to dollars, I guess.
Well, yeah. Twice as many dollars to pennies nowadays.
Yeah. How about you? What's it like on the major label side?
What's it like on the major label side? You know what? I don't know quite how to answer that question, but I'll answer it with an anecdote of some form or other. So about 5 months ago, I was at a meeting with a head of marketing for a very large brand. And they were boasting about a particular ad campaign that they'd run. And they were boasting that it was 30% effective, that they'd actually targeted, and with their fantastically targeted, you know, mainstream media campaign, they targeted 30% of the consumers they were hoping to get. And that was a huge success for them. They were actually, somebody got promoted, there was a pay rate. And I was thinking about it, and I was thinking, that means 70% of the marketing budget is totally wasted. And it doesn't have to be in an online world where you can actually really target in a very granular way. And over the next 1, 2, 3 years, more and more executives that are actually in charge of the ad dollars will finally be getting that message and going, 70% waste is unacceptable. And at that point in time, the dollars will start flowing in a much more regular manner. I mean, there's not even enough inventory at the moment to cope with some of the demand, especially video inventory. So I think the ecosystem is going to change dramatically over the next 3 or 4 years. It already has changed, but it will continue to change radically. So, I mean, to some degree, the value of music as a percentage of the ad revenue gained from any particular place is going to change dramatically as well. So it's not a static target. It's going to move and hopefully move in the right direction. There was another statistic I had as well, and I can't remember what it was. I'll think of it.
Jump in when you do. This is for Steve and Peter. You've built a business on ad-supported. Tell the audience a little bit about how it works and why it works.
So fundamentally, we look at our service as a platform and a network. We're not I think there are a lot of sites out there that do a really good job at being a curator or an editorial service. whether it's a blog or it's a social network. We built an infrastructure so that users could connect with each other, express themselves with each other via streaming and cool applications and tools on the site. They're both extendable outside as widgets and apps, but they're also most strong and most available on our service at our destination. What we wanted to do was tap into how users actually use the internet rather than force them into some wonky reapplication of what we thought they'd want to do or whatever would fit our business model. So we looked at the user experience and said, how do we create an open funnel or an open user flow where we're getting basically out of the way of the user? The situation, for better or for worse right now, is that music is ubiquitously free to almost anyone that has an internet connection. There are also a ton of social sites where a lot of that is also sort of in a gray area of streaming for free under the premise of marketing promotion, which I agree with. But what we wanted to do was be able to tap into the concept that you can create this user-generated, crowdsourced online music community that was vibrant and that was built by a real community rather than sort of forced upon them. And then create a way where there was a business model that made sense, where you could get all the marketing promotion benefit, but at the very same exact time, also provide revenue opportunities for those artists or labels. So we use content filtering, audio fingerprinting, video fingerprinting to check what the users are uploading, check it against the registry, apply rights based upon what the content owners want. And the content owner can be an artist, or they can be a label, or an aggregator, or distributor. And what it basically allows is control and participation in the system from all the different parties, not just users, not just us, but users, artists, labels, us, rights holders. So, we're still figuring it out. And so we're constantly in sort of look and learn mode with the community.
Well, it's interesting what Steve just said about moving beyond marketing and promotion. There was this little thing that started in the 80s called MTV. That also professed to be all about marketing and promotion, and no money is ever funneled back to the record labels. So I'd like to ask the two labels, what are your thoughts on free and return for marketing and promotion?
You know what my thoughts are. I need.
Okay, I set you up for that.
I need more marketing and promotion on the internet, like I need a root canal without anesthetic. It's irrelevant to me at the moment. I mean, clearly you have to build demand before you can satisfy demand. We understand that. But it is up to us as right holders to actually create compelling content and create, unique and wonderful new things that the digital age can make. It's not just a bunch of bits, and we actually have to supply context. And I think that then it's up to the partners to create community and that viral effect, and so that you're getting much more than just like if you go to BitTorrent and download the song. It's not just about the song. Music isn't just about the one thing. It's about a whole range of other things that make the culture propel. So it's really up to us to be able to try and grasp that nettle and provide the consumer with stuff that is of value to them so they're willing to pay it in whatever form they want to pay it in. I don't care whether it's subscription or ad-supported or whether they want to do a la carte downloads. It really doesn't matter as long as they're doing something that is helping us reinvest back into more bands and so the culture can thrive.
I mean, Simon, what are your thoughts on marketing promotion? I mean, the indies and specifically your group have always been against DRM and wanting to make it easy for the consumer, and the indies in general seem to be a little bit more seeing the return on investment for providing something at a lower cost. What are your thoughts?
The amount of people that approach us and say, we've got this great new service, we can deliver your content out to whatever the number is, it's fantastic promotion. We're not interested in an offer like that. Promotion's great, but only when it's built on a sound commercial base. The people that say, well, we can provide a link to your website or to Amazon or to iTunes, we've never seen any significant results coming from those channels. Yeah. Going back to MTV, in Europe, MTV pays the indies, not only the majors. And that's something we had to fight very hard for. And we convinced MTV and the powers that be at MTV that there was a value in our music there, to the point that we were going to pull you know, the indies in generally were going to pull all of their catalog from MTV. And it kind of went down to the wire, and MTV blinked because they knew they needed our catalogs as much as they needed the majors' catalogs. And I think that's a real statement from one of the most powerful sort of entities, certainly through the 80s, 90s, and the first part of this decade as well, to admit that there is a value in our music, and they would pay us, and it's not an insignificant fee either. So I think from that moment onwards, it really reinforced that our rights do have a value. People are, you know, we're happy to license our music. You can go off and sell advertising. You can go and, you know, build it into your business as well. But we need to be paid. And if we're not paid, I'm afraid we don't want to do business with you.
Well, the Europeans also pay artists for radio play. So I think the Europeans are
such an advanced culture.
Are far ahead on who gets paid for what. Just to give the audience some background, in the United States, performances are paid by BMI and ASCAP to songwriters and publishers, but the actual singer artist does not get paid when that song is on the radio. And there's a big movement going on in Washington to make that change. But the Europeans have long do that, and it's actually a big source of revenue for artists. The only revenue that artists get in the United States on that is internet radio, which Sound Exchange collects for artists. Totally off subject. I apologize. Just thought I'd share that.
Well, actually, that's not off topic, because I think a large part of why ad-supported music is such a new and unfamiliar topic for the music industry is that they're just not used to it. They haven't received a revenue stream from it.
Right.
So it's a totally new
it is a new revenue stream.
This is uncharted territory for most artists and labels. And so they've seen this revenue flow, this economic flow happening, but it just happens outside of their realm. And so that's a big difference from what's happening in Europe, where they already understand that revenue.
They know the revenue.
So a lot of the early market development, as opposed to like, just, I'm not even talking about like doing deals and licenses and all that. I'm talking about like the concept getting sort of, you know, understood and well received. I mean, it took a long time. Like, it took us over a year and a half just to get everyone comfortable with the idea of a free, on-demand, fully interactive social music experience, where you weren't charging the consumer, the user,
right,
the fan, money out of their pocket. Like we were saying, you know, you can monetize attention rather than a product sale out of a consumer's wallet, which is, you know, I think the North American music market was in total like $10 billion last year, $9 billion. And, you know,
It used to be like 15.
Yeah. And then
it used to be 15 billion only a couple of years ago. It's gone down a lot. Yeah.
But brand advertisers spend like $250 billion just in traditional media and online media.
Mm-hmm.
And then in online media, they've spent $25 or $30 billion last year. So that's triple the size.
And in some sections, it hasn't moved at all. We're involved in a sort of music and fashion enterprise at the moment, just getting it out off the ground. And we did a lot of research into sort of beauty and fashion advertising. And pretty much none of the $18 billion that is actually in that sort of ecosystem has flown into the internet. None of it has.
Wow.
Like, so partly because, you know, of old practices, they're still looking at runways and, you know, Vogue and whatever, but partly because it's not an environment, you know, there haven't been that many environments that they've actually wanted to advertise. If you're, you know, a high-end fashion couture brand, you don't want to be next to a lower your mortgage ad. But again, that's part of this, the business changing, and as the business changes, the art changes as well. We're moving from a product-based business to a service business, and it's not an easy trick to reinvent yourself as you're moving. But we're attempting to. And some people are doing it.
Yeah, I was just going to say, Peter, how does record label sort of fit into the ecosystem?
Well, I think to be honest, I'm not interested in the music industry at all, in the traditional sense. I think we're creating a completely different kind of business. We're really blogging business, a social media business. And, we look at music as something that has a very different value. It's not about trying to extract as much value out of every time someone downloads a track, whether it's, you know, 99 cents or a certain amount of advertising revenue. It's really looking at creating sites or a network of sites where you're creating a relationship with an audience. And, you know, you're monetizing that audience through advertising, yes, but it's really about thinking about music as a social online experience rather than a retail experience. And you know, we don't do things like force people to watch a bunch of ads before they can download a track or anything like that. We look at it like the product is the blog, and music and the downloads that we offer are part of that, but that it's really about thinking of it as a larger package. I mean, we don't just throw up a page with a bunch of links to download tracks. We actually blog about the music and talk about what we're doing and offer a variety of different widgets and, you know, have a podcast and things like that, and really think of it as like, you know, we're a niche product. We've moved away from mass media and towards niche media. And in that world, it's about going very, very deep with your audience. And, you know, I mean, I see us as being very kind of complementary to what Steve is doing with IME. I mean, we're kind of like, you know, consumers don't just have one place that they experience music online. It's a variety of different places. They might, you know, go and discover a band on MySpace or Facebook or iLike, and they might, you know, create a widget on iMeme, and then they might go to iTunes and download some music there. Though the only people I know that download music from iTunes that are under 30 are when they get a gift card from their parents for Christmas. You know, I mean, think about it. Like, if you're,
that's,
you
know, true. Actually, if you're a freshman in college, to get all the iPods.
If you're a freshman in college right now, you have basically known Napster. You've had Napster since you were like 9 or 10. It's never not been there. That sort of experience of getting music for free. And so, you know, we're trying to create something that is in sync with that, that recognizes that consumers today, you know, are used to getting music online, it being free, and it being something that they consume and discover in a social online experience. And so we're about, you know, curation. We're about, you know, recognizing that music blogs are a huge force in music right now. And in some ways, a lot more important than the labels, because that's where bands are being discovered and broken and exposed and promoted. And so, you know, with Record Label, we're creating something that is a part of that world. That's the world I care about.
How many people in the audience discover music through blogs?
Thank you.
I know Ted's been dying to say something, so yeah, please jump in.
This either-or thing is just totally irrelevant to me. Like, Record Label, I mean, like, if you call yourself a company called Record Label, clearly there's a bow to the past anyway. There is no there is no difference. Like, really, all that people have ever done, whether it's buy a concert ticket, a T-shirt, an album, you know, buy the lyrics or the, you know, the guitar tablature, is purchase access to an artist at some point. That's all that they were like, because that artist has some sort of emotional resonance to their life. So sometimes that's now free. Different people want different forms of access. They want different forms of entertainment from that artist. But the idea of, oh, it's a blog and this is radically different to, you know, creating, is bullshit. I mean, it's all the same. We get caught.
The difference is we make money.
We get caught up in the sort of like the means of delivery, and that all is going to work itself out and is continuing to work itself out. It's really all about, you know, just making sure that the artist and the consumer have all sorts of different and fundamentally entertaining ways of interacting with each other.
But I mean, you can say that, but I think the underlying cost structures of our businesses are completely different.
How come?
Well, we're not trying to sell music.
Yes, you are.
But you are selling music.
Yes, you are.
We're not.
That's how you're making advertising money, though. You're selling music to make ad money.
But our underlying cost structure is completely different. We pay artists in a completely different way than you do.
We have ads. We have all sorts of ad-supported sites as well, and we're making money out of it. Well,
yeah,
exactly.
You have
what's
a fixed
the difference
amount
between
that
one
you have
ad-supported
to make,
site and another?
But the thing is, you have a fixed amount. Like, just what Simon's saying, that you have a fixed amount of money that you need to make per track.
No.
To pay your artists.
No.
No, not necessarily.
We have many different revenue.
Well, what
models.
I'm saying
no,
is that, like, but
all.
you have a threshold that you
I mean,
need
I
to
like
reach.
The
otherwise,
idea,
you're not going to. No, but you have a threshold
true.
That you need to reach. Otherwise, you're not going to license the music. That's what Simon just said earlier.
That's not necessarily true.
Okay, but that's what Simon said. That's all. Awesome.
It varies.
I didn't say anything about a fixed set of money. I said there was a value to music.
That's what I'm saying. But you have a threshold that you need to reach. Otherwise, you're not going to offer the music.
It depends on the artist. The value always depends on the artist and what the economics are, what the advance might have been, what the recruitment is, what the royalty rate is, right?
And the value of that artist in the marketplace.
Right. And the value of the brand.
So, and if I can just add one thing about Peter's blog. I mean, the one thing that Peter is doing is being really transparent about what he's offering. There's a whole stack of blogs out there, you know, tons of them. There's advertising in many shapes or forms. Some of them are simple little Google AdWords or little blog ads, and some of them are far more advanced. Now, they're all there selling advertising on their blog and just going, hey, guys, you know, we're just writing a blog and whatever. But Peter's being really transparent about it. He goes, people are coming here to get the music. We're going to monetize and share that with labels and artists. And I think, you know, that's a really transparent, honest and open statement. And that's what blogging's about.
But I think the point that Ted was trying to make is that you are in the music business. You are making money off music.
I mean, we're in the music business, but I'm saying I'm not interested in the traditional model. That's what I'm saying.
Nor are we.
That's so different.
I don't really see the difference. So, but I guess, I mean, I'm not interested in trying to think of music as something that is sold, period.
Even though you're making money on it. Okay.
To me, we're
more like a blogging business than a music.
What do you guys think? Well, what do you think about, do you think music blogs?
I think it's a lot less than it used to.
I'd like to ask the audience, if you guys think music blogs are making money off music, raise your hand. Don't worry, I won't, okay. So I think that's, you're kind of iffy. Who thinks that music blogs are not making money off music?
I think it's the wrong question to ask. Yeah.
Okay, well, phrase the question differently. I'd like to know what the audience thinks.
Well, we are not in the business of trying to sell music as a retail object, period.
It's still based on intellectual property in music, right? What you're talking
about? No, we Creative Commons license our music.
Right. Okay.
Yeah, that's.
Right. Do you really want to get into publishing?
No.
No, I think I understand. I think it's semantics. I think we're all sort of. Into a revenue share. Okay.
Well, I mean, that goes back to my.
I like this heated discussion.
What I will tell you is that there are many, many people that we license our music to that pay us on the ad. So clearly somebody's making money out of our music and they're paying us on a share of the advertising. And I don't understand why that's so radically different to your business. I think it's all good, but I don't really, it's the same business. There's some intellectual property, there's a lot of content.
But I take questions in five.
You make from advertising?
And then everyone in the audience can ask questions.
Wait,
I promise.
Let Rob ask his question.
Hold on one second.
You're going to be the first. Just give me like a couple minutes.
So a lot of bloggers use iMe. We have a large and growing community. They use not only iMeme.com, but they use the widgets and apps. Bloggers to me, so I come from DJ culture back in the day, and it's a loose analogy, but it's very similar to me, just like DJs were. There would be some labels and some artists that say, I don't want you playing my music. I need some type of economic benefit. But the large majority would opt in and say, hell yes, I want to be, like, please play me on the air. Please play me at the club. Please do. I'll give you my records. I'm going to follow you and give you my records. And so in the end, this is not like a black or white thing. It's not like, you are monetizing it or you're not, and you're gaining advantage or you're not. And it's not like this binary. It's, you know, it's not so cut and dry. I mean, I think there is great marketing and promotion. And if you offer an opportunity for revenue in a capitalist market, that's good. People will select your service, and that's what a record label, and that's what, you know, a lot of different, like Pitchfork is on iMeme. I use Hype Machine as well. There are so many different outlets. These are like DJs to me. And so I don't think it's just, oh, well, we monetize it and then that's bad or that's good. I mean, there's like basically the new format right now is that marketing and promotion can have a revenue share, as you said. And, labels need to embrace that, and they are starting to. Not as quickly as we all would like, but, you know, we're getting there. Whereas the last 10 years, like we had a presentation to a label about what has happened in the last 10 years in both the technology business on the internet as well as digital music. They shut down Napster 10 years ago, basically. Like since then, not 10 years ago, but if Napster was popular at its peak, 80 million persistent users at one time. In that 10 years, Google has become, you know, an amazing internet company, amazing story in taking technology, innovating our experiences. And digital music, you know, not much has moved in that 10-year period. So there's a rift here, and the music industry is catching up. And it's cool. It's good. Finally good to see that. But I don't think that it's mutually exclusive. I think actually, I don't want to be like the peace broker or anything. But I think you guys are actually saying the same thing. It's just, you know. Anyways.
I also, I mean, one of the, we haven't talked about subscription yet, but it's clear that like, at some point, somebody will crack the... where's Mr. Krinsky? Is he still around? Somebody will crack the subscription nut, and actually consumers will begin to understand, you know, wow, it's only whatever that number is, $5, $10 or whatever else. I pay more for, you know, there are all sorts of hidden charges on your phone every month that you have no idea. Nobody can possibly work out what those charges are. And if you add up those like hidden charges, that would probably be more than enough to cover a monthly subscription fee for you for a year for your music. Now, the trouble is that at the moment, nobody that hasn't experienced subscription wants to experience it. It's one of those things that's like the Matrix.
Isn't it sort of like cable and TV? If you look at the ad-based model versus the subscription
model. Yeah, exactly. But you have to know, it's kind of it's a little bit more, for some reason, it just seems to be a very hard concept to get across. I don't know why, but it seems to be that once people have been hooked on it, they never want to go back. But getting people hooked on it, and I know I'm talking like a drug dealer, but that's what our business was based on. Once people have experienced it, it's a fantastic experience. And then if you could share it with other people that are also subscription members, if you can get to scale quickly, if everybody that had a wireless account, you know, suddenly was paying without even knowing about it because it was so minimal, you got to scale, you could drop the price, and everybody could start sharing music all over the place, and the world would be a wonderful place.
But would you offer your
I swear I'm going to let everyone rush the stage in like 3 minutes.
So, I mean, I'm actually a Rhapsody subscriber. I pay, you know, like $15 a month, and I download a lot of music that way. But I find that the DRM is a huge, huge hassle, and it doesn't work very well. And I'm wondering, now that labels
DRM
are starting to
DRM is
embrace,
over.
Yeah, that's a
DRM is done.
Again, that's irrelevant too.
No, but what I'm saying is, would you guys license your catalog to a Rhapsody-like service without the DRM requirements?
I don't know how subscription works without some form of DRM.
But that's what I'm asking.
And that's a technology.
That's the eMusic is a subscription with no DRM. So, no, I mean, it is possible, but it's only populated by indies.
Okay, I see so many impassioned people that are just dying to say something. I am going to open it up. I just want to say one final note for food for thought is that historically, music has always sold other products, which is kind of interesting. If you look at RCA, which is one of the major label groups today. They actually started in 1920s as a phonograph producer, like the old phonographs. And their phonographs weren't selling that well, so they started making music to sell phonographs. And I think a lot of that still exists in our business today. So that's my... Oh, wait, no.
I have okay. Actually. So before Steve Jobs and the iPod, before he discovered music, Apple had a market cap of $9 billion. I think
and music
as of today,
sells iPods.
Like after... After the inclusion of music with his product, I think it's now at $102 billion.
Yes, perfect example.
Cap. So, I mean, it's clear that a lot of people are making a lot of money off artists' work. We just have to make sure that money is redistributed back to the artists as well.
Okay, guys, open forum. I know the first question, that someone was in line first. You get the first question, and then you're next. Hit us.
Hi, I'm Rob Lord. I know most of you, although I need to spend a little more time talking with you, Ted. It's probably not good that I'm the first question because I like asking scope buster questions. But because this is South By, because we've got a lot of geek heads here, like no bullshit, you know, geek monkeys. Peter, this one's for you.
I like that, no bullshit geek monkeys.
Yeah. So, you know, it's easy to browbeat the media industry with how smart we are in our tech stuff. But are the tools, I mean, I want to kind of hold you to what you were doing with Ted there. How effective actually are the tools now? How much of the value are you actually capturing using the blog tool that you're currently using? How much more is there yet to come, and how does that influence some of the discussion that you were just having?
By value, what do you mean? Just give me more specific about what you mean.
I mean, they just talked about that. They said, you know, for instance, Apple's value was the example. Yeah. You should know this about your business, and it's helpful for all of us to know. Are you capturing 5% of the value that could be created by having this music on there? Is it 50%? Is it
90%? How much value is music bringing
and,
to
and
your
site? If not, like
is that
what are the architecture tools? What are, if you will, the methods, formats, and protocols of your blog system whereby more value can be captured and returned, presumably, or distributed, shared among the value creators of, of the value chain?
There's always a lot more that can be done. And, you know, I feel like...
No. You got to be better.
Wait. First off, I mean, we're a small startup. We're not trying to build
No. Like, come on. Like,
okay, you asked the question.
Okay. You want me to answer the question or not?
Don't let him answer it.
Don't let him be anything less than the full geek monkey he is.
You've been called out as a geek monkey, so I think you better.
I don't know. I'm not a programmer, so I'm not going to claim to be that geeky. But, you know, look, it is a challenge, right? And what we're trying to do is to recognize that, and don't interrupt me, okay?
You must ask a question and let them respond.
We're offering the music for free without DRM, right? And so we're recognizing that there's actually going to be some value that we can't capture, that there are going to be people that share the music and, you know, email it to a friend or IM it to a friend, and we might not necessarily get any traffic out of that. And I think, you know, we don't have a good estimate for what that is because, you know, how can you know without DRM? You can't completely control how people use your content. And I think the trade-off is we're willing to accept a little bit of sort of shrinkage, like they say in the retail industry, and recognize that, you know, we'd rather create something, put it out there and not put restrictions on it and let people enjoy it and put on as many devices as they want. And hopefully that will create a good relationship with the people who use the site rather than sort of, and I think DRM makes the default assumption that you're a thief, that the user is a thief and that they need to be controlled in some way. And so, you know, could we be capturing more value in the sense that we could, you know, I would love for 100% of the people that are enjoying the music we put out there to have gotten it from us and to be a regular visitor of the site. But I recognize that that is not going to happen.
You have real numbers when you go to your advertising.
No. Absolutely.
So if I understand that,
we're
right,
gonna, we got a whole big line.
I just want to make sure I understand. So the answer is either you don't know or DRM could potentially add more value.
No. I don't think DRM would add value. I think it would subtract value because I think it would shrink the number of people who would
get right,
it.
Right.
Okay, next question.
But
thank
there
you.
There are probably ways that you're
thank
looking
you.
At to create
we
a
could argue this for hours. I want to make sure that everyone gets a chance to ask a question. Go ahead.
I think a lot of the barrier to experimenting with a bunch of these crazy new models, ad-driven in particular, is that the kind of deal-making costs are very high because you don't know what rates you're going to get when you go to the table. It takes a lot of business development suits to even kind of get to a number. In fact, a sub-question would be sort of maybe some specifics on numbers per play, the iMeme in particular. And secondly, what would everyone feel about a compulsory rate for using the sound recording?
You said the big C word. What do you guys think about compulsory?
So personally, I think a standardized compulsory rate would be amazing because then you could compete or differentiate on marketing value and product features and user experience and not like compete, as you said, with the suits, like negotiating licenses that aren't based on fact, right? They're preemptive in advance of fact. And so who knows what the right level is or who knows if we're even structuring it the right way. And so, you know, like all the businesses up here, bar none, have to deal with the reality that there is gaps in information. There are gaps in information in the market. So we just got to do the best possible thing where it balances everyone's interest and proceed and figure it out. What it requires, though, is, you know, let me put it this way, partner friendliness and collaboration rather than like just sort of blind aggression, right? Like, we're only going to, like the music, the digital music industry has not worked to the level that it could have. I mean, people love music, and I'd argue that people identify more by music in their lifestyle and their self-expression than any other medium. But yet it seems to be the most divisive and like just fragmented and like high friction area of what we do on a daily basis, right? So look, it's tough. Revenue share is obviously the goal because that's pro rata to the amount of value. And by the way, to the previous question, one thing I wanted to make a note of is this is like a free market. So the people, the artists and labels who are putting their content on a site like Record Label, they're self-selecting themselves to do it. So to them, value is a relative thing. They're getting a lot of market value and they want to do it. So it's not like anyone's forcing anyone to have their content on Record Label or a blog site. A lot of these bloggers receive, like you talk to Pitchfork, you talk to Gorilla versus Bear, you know, labels and artists and managers are sending these MP3s saying post it. So let's not lose sight of the fact that there's self-selection happening.
I want to stay on compulsory real quick. Simon, the labels have kind of
compulsory
different view.
Isn't really an answer when it's in a free market, but I think statutory licensing where there's a known set rate that whoever uses music knows what they've got to pay, I think that's an interesting concept, and it would certainly open up the market a lot and it would level the playing field a lot, and it would certainly give you the freedom to be either making music available or not to make music available, depending on what the artist or label's wishes are. So I'd say statutory is far more interesting. Compulsory isn't something which should be applied in a free market.
Next question.
Okay, so to reiterate, you've got three models, subscription-based, you've got the pay-per-download type model, and then you've got advertising-funded. they all have parallels in the real world. Advertising funded, radio, at least, maybe not in the US, some from
TV.
Canada. TV is subscription-based.
Cable.
Cable is subscription-based, and then pay per download is sort of like you've got a product.
Or pay-per-view,
But you've got a product, you own it in the end. So I can see advertising, the parallel works great, that radio, that type of thing, the advertising funds, eventually when the volumes and the numbers and all that stuff gets checked, that can work. Subscription is one that the record companies are chasing after, and sorry, I'm not going to try and pick on you, but the record companies are trying to chase after it because it's a great way to reoccurring money. But the consumers, where's the value that they get out of that? Because at the end of the day, they don't own anything. They're pumping money in. And if you look at what happened with cable television shows, people went out as soon as they became available on VHS or DVD. If they liked it, they get it. Now they can go to iTunes and they can download it and pay for it on iTunes and that kind of thing. So it's either a thing of I'm listening to it sort of like in the background, or I'm listening to it in my everyday life from a radio perspective, or this perspective of
I have one question first for the audience. How many people here participate in a subscription service? And you're cool with not owning the music? You don't really want to own it. It takes up a lot of space. It's not about ownership. I see. That's why I'm asking the questions.
Well, you can still buy it.
Okay.
So here's the other question, though. How many in here?
Let me answer your first question.
Okay.
And that is, if you have access to the music wherever you want it, when you want, and I'm not saying that like technology has necessarily helped us, nor am I saying that like the music business over the last 10 years has made all the right moves. However, I do think that there's an aspect of subscription that is interesting because it is it allows people to discover music without having to pay extra for it. So that then you can start using all that community and connectivity that the internet actually has as that two-way street and all the nichification that's happening and actually really be able to consume more music that you like but you don't know you'd like. And that's why it's interesting to us. And if it's available everywhere, wherever you are, then who needs to own it? Now I sound like somebody that is... But what I'm saying is there may be music, like again, just as I said that there are different people want to consume in different ways, there'll be people that want to buy it, that are using subscription to sample everything, and then the two things that week or whatever else that are so fantastic because they've rediscovered whatever it is, the Breeders or Feist or whatever, they want to buy that because they want to buy it.
Well, what's interesting
But there are other people that will never want to buy anything, that ownership just doesn't mean anything anymore.
The biggest problem with subscriptions has been the implementation. It's been very poor.
Right.
By and large. And, we all know that Steve Jobs and Apple are actually working on this right now. And, they might introduce it and get it right, and that might make a big difference.
Did you have a second part of your question, or can we go to the next one?
The second part on subscription is the people that are buying music are still people that don't have the ability to pay for a subscription because they're in that age bracket where they don't have credit cards and so on. Again, where the idea of having it anytime, anywhere, advertising funded makes more sense.
That's not a question.
But, okay.
Next question, please.
It's a statement.
It's a statement. No statements, questions.
Okay, I'm working on
it. I appreciate statements, but not right now.
This is a great panel. I think this is one of the most dynamic issues in the industry. I mean, it's fantastic. I'm a 20-year music industry veteran composer since full-time, and got a lot of music on NBC, Fox, MTV, Disney, and I've been around the block with big and small companies and everything. And I started a company called Fantones.com, and it takes care of a lot of these different things, but I think there's a psychology on both sides of the extreme where the big labels for years, because I deal with independent artists all the time, and they feel alienated a lot of times, even just, hey, we got a record offer, here's a contract. Well, when you have things like controlled composition clauses and unbreakable goods and things that Mickey Mouse math from, decades and decades ago that don't really apply anymore, it starts to alienate the new artist where they start to feel taken advantage of. And then you have, the new types of sites where I don't agree with the downloads being free and some of these because the artist must eat. And
but you're not you don't have to sign up with us if you don't want to.
Okay, thank you. But with the big labels, like with Interscope, I mean, how do you guys address, I think, the alienation with independent artists, why they're so like, hey, let's get our music out there because it's a, hey, we need to express ourselves. I mean, are you guys changing publishing contracts or some of the ways that things have been done for decades and decades?
I think the question is, just to kind of explain it to the audience, there are still some recording contracts that have very odd clauses in them, like breakage, which applies to vinyl, which isn't made a lot anymore. I mean, there's a lot of weird clauses and record contracts that are very old that are still binding artists to certain percentages that are taken off of their royalties that shouldn't be. So the question is, are these contracts being adapted for newer artists?
There's still controlled composition clauses, very common.
Well, we're not going to get super granular, but I think that's like
But those things do matter, and that's why independent artists goes to sites like Record Label and the other ones, because...
Well, let's let Ted answer the question.
Somewhere in there was a question. But
I think the question is, are you adapting your recording contracts to apply to new technologies?
Do our recording contracts still talk about vinyl and breakage? No. I haven't seen one, for the last 6 months.
Or packaging.
But I believe that they are better. Again, listen, we're adapting all these things, but most of the packaging costs are incurred because artists really want that packaging. We're shoving packaging costs down, artists' throats. Most of the times, I want to be printed on this paper and that paper, and you sort of present the case that potentially 50% of your audience is actually going to buy it on iTunes, and it really doesn't matter what paper stock you use. But, again, one of the wonderful things about, our business is that we are in the business of helping artists, achieve their vision, and they are artists, and they're not, it's not like we're in the aspirin business. Aspirins don't answer back. It's very easy to market aspirin. Our artists answer back, and they have needs, and they have wants, and
I
they have irrational.
EMI is learning that.
Yeah, exactly. My point. A lot of the costs in contracts, or a lot of aren't contract bound. They're artists, wishes. We try and, make our artists happy.
Thank you. Next question.
My question is actually about the long-term sustainability of the ad-supported music model. Obviously, something being ad-supported is not an original idea. For example, newspapers and magazines, which with increasing advertisers going to the internet, those models are failing. So in the future, when perhaps advertisers aren't as interested in supporting something online, do you think that ad-supported music is...
All right, the reason why ads are leaving the newspaper business is because they're going online. So actually, it's going to benefit us, it's not to our detriment.
Well, what's going to be next? Is it going to go mobile?
And you actually answered, kind of helped answer your own question, which is, you're right. It's totally not a new, ingenious new model that whiz bang, wow, cool. It's already out there. The ad dollars, the brands. So we've spent the last year working with brands and agencies and media planners, and they're aching for an opportunity to advertise directly against and around and sponsor music and artists. They just haven't had many channels or outlets to do that. It's been Yahoo, AOL, MTV, yeah. And then the Coca-Cola's and Pepsi's of the world just go direct through management right into artists and do artist endorsement and stuff like that. And that's been pretty much it. Radio is a very local thing. It's the targeting isn't great, and they're just kind of disenchanted. So, the social networks, the blogs, even the I have questions, deep concerns about an ad-supported download model, just because it's very unitary and it's hard to sustain that. But outside of that, I think you're right. I think it is sustainable. I'm answering your question, which is I think it is sustainable because there's a lot of pent-up demand for it from that market. If that demand didn't exist right now, then I think it wouldn't be sustainable.
I think the platform may change. I mean, there's no advertising
right.
whatsoever.
I think it's going to go to mobile eventually.
Mobile advertising at the moment is in the dark ages. And if you, in other territories, it's far, far more advanced than, let's say, it is in the U.S. So the platform, again, just what we've talked about music consumption, the platform may change, but the basic models are nothing. It's nothing. This isn't rocket science.
John, you're up, and then I'm going to stop the line.
I'd like to address I'd like to address the idea that music should be...
No, you guys are cool. You can stay.
That music should be free because it's about the blogging or the social network experience, and that's why people come to these sites. All of patent law and all of copyright law was created based on the idea that intellectual work should be as much as value as physical work. And that work done by the mind should be worth as much as work done by the muscles. And so I wanted to ask you what you thought the reaction would be if you told your people who created your site, created your applications, created your widgets, that you weren't going to pay them because it's all about the blogging experience.
Are you asking me?
Yeah.
But we do pay our artists.
Yeah, but you don't set the value on their intellectual work as equal to the value that the people who program your site get.
But the art, I'll defend you now. The artists that are contributing to Record Label, they're actually contributing to Record Label. I mean, it's not like anybody's twisting their arm to do so.
But it might be some other
blogs. And they may well be making money out of the touring, out of T-shirt merch or whatever else, right. Because, again, they're engaging an audience. Just as Prince is, you know, gave away his album to the Daily Mail. Like, again, he gave it for free, but then he played 21 consecutive nights at the O2
Center. And they paid him a lot of money to put it in the Daily Mail.
So, I mean, it's a choice that artists can make. Well, our point, I guess, would be that it's when the artist's choice is removed, that's when it's, you know, irritated, and that's when, like, we end up in, you know, trouble.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks. Next question.
Well, first I wanted to say here to the statutory or the concept of at least having transparency and what the price is, because I think we can create a lot of innovation.
Are you talking about statutory or compulsory?
Definitely not compulsory.
Statutory.
Yeah, statutory or some variation of that. And that's, I actually wanted to talk about the variation, specifically variable pricing. Because really what I'm hearing is some people say music should be free and some people say that it should be paid and it's precious or I don't care at all. I think the Radiohead model was a nice data point of showing all the different price points. That people
well, we'll see how the Charlatans and Nine Inch Nails do, too. Yeah. But Radiohead also spent 10 years being built on the back of a major label.
After 15 million pounds worth of investment.
I didn't mean to say Radiohead.
Sorry. I didn't mean to jump on you.
Let's not focus on
Okay, we're not focusing on Radiohead. Ask your question.
It's hard not to. I know. But let's focus on variable pricing and its viability as a potential solution when paired with transparency, sort of like a Google AdSense model, where you could go and actually have programmers on your site, on iMeme or on Record Label, that would know the value or how much the revenue share would or the per track play would be. And is this a dumb idea? B, what are the barriers to it? And C, where's the right place for that to live?
I think it's a really interesting idea, and it's one that's been posed a few times. And we live in a somewhat strange industry that just when the demand is highest, i.e. around release date, we actually charge the least. Which is somewhat counterintuitive, and some people would say that not necessarily the smartest thing in the world. But that goes to your point about, like, you know, is there a way of potentially charging for demand, you know, and making a more scale pricing? I mean, I think that, you know, all those models have been looked into and are being looked into now.
So just to add on to that, in downloads and product sales, I think variable pricing, that would be really cool, just as a user, as a fan. I'd like to see that in action. You need an open market. You need like real-time data. You need like liquidity of data. It's just an economic like challenge.
It's very difficult to do as well.
Yeah, it's logistically tough.
Also, I mean, Mr. Jobs would say, and you know, it's not like the labels haven't thought about this. We wanted variable pricing to begin with, and certainly Apple's idea was, no, it's a 99-cent store. We have to make it very simple for the consumer, because if you say, well, it could be 62.5 cents or it could be 49.5 cents, depending whether it's a morning or afternoon, you'll lose the consumer. So, I mean, and like him, dislike him, admire him, not. I mean, the guy is a marketing genius. I would say that potentially he has, you know, he understands the consumer better than some of us do. So, like, maybe it has to be kept simple for the moment.
And the one thing about, just to add to that, is an ad-supported environment is actually a market-driven variable pricing environment, if you think about it, right? Your currency as a user is not your dollar, but it's your time. It's your attention. And so advertisers will seek to advertise against or sponsor that content which they deem of high quality for their particular marketing purposes. So what you end up having in aggregate is a variable pricing mechanism. It's just the source of where that subsidy comes from, that money comes from a different source, right? Rather than out of the wallet of the consumer. So.
And that once again is coming to like paying for engagement as opposed to paying for product. It's a different business.
I'm sorry, I can't hear you. He says there's still a minimum payment per play, is what he said. Well, Okay, we're going to take the next question. Yeah.
I would just like to speak quickly from the perspective of an artist. I'm actually on a band on one of Simon's labels. I've never met you, Peter, but I've been talking to Elliot a lot about doing something with record label. Cool. And personally, I think actually in defense of Peter, they're providing something that's of a lot of value to artists. In response to John's question about intellectual property, I think more so than a site, as much as I love it, like Brooklyn Vegan, Gorilla versus Bear, Stereo Gum, these are sites that are monetizing music. And they're doing it without paying the artists, which, you know, as everyone keeps saying, the artists are volunteering for this. If you can imagine an environment of radio where as many people find out about music from radio as they do today, but there's no standards for paying, as there is, at least in the United States, there's standards for paying the publishing side and the writing side. But if there is no standards for that, I mean, as Simon pointed out, more and more, I think we as artists look at our music almost as an inevitable loss leader. It's a way for us to create audiences so we can tour, so we can make money with merchandise, and that's how.
Yeah, but the record labels want part of that too.
Right. Well,
that's, we're investing 100% of the cost. Why wouldn't we take a little bit of the upside of any potential investment?
I went off the subject again. I'm well, sorry. No, finish your question.
No, it's okay. And if a record label is investing 100% of the cost of creating a brand, that would make sense. I don't think that that's the case with the majority of artists, because most of the development is done on the artist side. I think that's especially where Peter has an interesting point about his cost structure being different, is that they're not like radio, they're more like TV. They're investing specifically in things that they have exclusive licenses for, and they're building an environment where people go to that site because of their selection, whereas the other blogs are working as radio. A radio station doesn't invest in the music that they play. They play the music that's going on, and they pay royalty rates. But I guess my question would be, how can you compete against other blogs that are providing this stuff for free? Like, how can you actually create a community that people will be willing to go to get exclusive content when there's so much unexclusive free content available that, as Simon pointed out, it's not transparent. They're
good question.
A lot of money.
Yeah, no, that's like the chief challenge of what we're trying to do. And, you know, we have to keep our cost structures very lean, you know, because of that. I mean, we have to be very conscious of how much we spend, not just in terms of paying the artists, but also just as a business itself, like our, you know, the cost of operation. And we have to try to always balance the sort of the formula, the ratio of what are we paying in terms of, you know, acquiring the content, so to speak, acquiring the music, in terms of what we can do in terms of monetizing it, in terms of advertising. And it's difficult. That's sort of the chief challenge of what we're doing. You know, we have been gotten a lot of, you know, we're very fortunate that blogs in general have been really good about linking to us rather than just rehosting the tracks. And most really understand and respect that, which I think is says a lot about, you know, the music blogosphere, that when you try to do something positive, that usually you get that sort of positivity returned back to you. And so we get linked to constantly from, you know, the Pitchforks and Stereo Gums and Gorilla versus Bears of the world. And they're always driving traffic to us, and they're sending their audience to us to get the music. But you're right. I mean, that's the chief challenge. It's like the one thing that keeps me up at night.
But the one good thing, I guess, in all our business is that the chairman of Procter & Gamble said that, you know, the consumer is the new marketer. That if people are having a great experience on that site, not only will they potentially share the music, but they'll also share the experience with 10 of their friends, and then those 10 friends will come back to record label. And
consumers are really wary of being treated that way. I mean, which is, it's the truth, but I'm just saying the more transparent that becomes, I feel like the more sort of scared people get about, like, you know, when they put widgets on the site, you just feel like you're part of someone's street team without, you know what I mean? Yeah. And so it's like.
We have time for one last question. Go ahead. Make it good.
Concerning the advertising agencies, I think they're very freaked out by all this money coming off the broadcast advertising and into these new media areas. Are they helping or hurting this transition to ad-supported music?
Oh, they're totally helping. And Peter should weigh in after, but I mean, these guys, look, they're always, so that it's, you got to kind of step in their shoes, like sit in their office, listen to them kind of gripe about what's their challenge right now. And they're always looking for that new product. Mm-hmm. Or that new shining, like, black box product that they can wrap up and give, because these brands are constantly looking for, you know, better targeting, better reporting, better value. So if you can provide them something that makes sense and actually, you know, the numbers back it up, they're really into it. So, you know, they go reach, frequency, engagement, et cetera, all the nice jargon. But those numbers actually, those figures actually really mean something when it comes to services like ours. How many people are watching it? How many people listen to the whole song rather than, like, you know, jump off after a couple seconds because they didn't like it?
Stickiness.
How are you presenting it? Are you presenting a cool experiential program for the brand, or are you just sitting there just slapping on a banner ad and being intrusive and interruptive and killing the user experience? Like all these things, that's like what, that's Peter and I's wheelhouse. That's what we're trying to figure out, is how to maintain a great user experience in the face of trying to monetize it so that the content owners and the artists and the brands are all happy. So that's kind of like the gauntlet that we run. And so if like Peter, I don't know if like he would agree with this, but I think they compete on their music opinions, their picks, their selection, and their ability to communicate that. And we compete on the ability to create great applications for users and a great like social web experience, like in terms of actual tools. So that I don't think it makes sense for us to compete in content licenses. That's why I think, you know, statutory, compulsory, I think these are all like interesting topics for us.
Okay, Ted has one more thing.
No, you can answer as well, but we're all actually in the same boat. I mean, we run a network of artist sites that have a combined reach of over 20 million unique. So we're in exactly the same boat. We're having the same advertiser meetings, and I think it's got considerably easier over the last. I mean, when I was at launch in 1999, and you sort of said, "Well, there's going to be this online experience. It's going to be an immersive environment, or whatever else." These people would just glaze and just have no clue what you were talking about. And now you start talking about engagement and premium content, and you know, sort of some sort of really integrated advertising, not just the banner there, but something that is engaging for the audience as well and non-intrusive. And they start to light up, and they start to look at, like, because they're going to lose their jobs very soon. If they can't find better ways of advertising and get out of the 70-30 ratio that I was talking about earlier, everybody, that whole sector is going to start suffering really badly. So we all benefit from that.
Unfortunately, that's it. Thank you to the panel. Thank you to the audience for being so lively. Thank you.